Okay, hi everyone, good evening. Thanks for coming out. I've been used to saying every week, thanks for coming out in a freezing evening. I guess it's a little less freezing tonight, which is good, so glad for everybody. Tonight is a special evening because we're bringing together two of the newest programs here in the shul. About 2 years ago, Naomi Landsman and Ricky Menser joined forces to create Dating Done Right, a program that not only helps create matches, focusing specifically on the men and women of our community, but also provides opportunities for education, for parents, and for those involved in the dating world. I should note that you're going to continue to hear more events and programs coming from DDR over the next few months, so please keep your eyes open for that. And in the same year, we also formed B'chol Nafshecha, the YOT Mental Health Initiative, with three committee members, Shani Barber, Dr. Judith Zucker, and Lisa Heller. And this program also has brought us numerous meaningful speakers on different topics in mental health, and maybe even more importantly, has made conversations about mental health commonplace now in the shul. A sign in the gallery that talks about anxiety is not surprising anymore. That's just what we do now. We talk about these topics all the time. Both groups ran programs in the fall, especially eating with Dr. Sarah Rohrer on body image and a very successful pizza making and matchmaking event a few weeks ago. And as we were looking towards the next event, so Naomi approached me with an idea. Rabbi Landsman had just heard this wonderful, amazing speaker at a conference for heads of school, Dr. David Rosemarin. And what would we think about bringing him in? And at that moment, we realized we had this opportunity to make this event a partnership between two groups. A discussion about maybe the number one talked about issue of mental health, anxiety, and to focus more specifically on how we can all better manage anxiety within our relationships, whether we're dating, whether we're newly married, married for decades, or managing any kind of relationship. And so we find ourselves here tonight with this unique opportunity to hear from our very special guest speaker. David H. Rosemarin, PhD, is an associate professor at Harvard Medical School, a program director at McLean Hospital, and founder of the Center for Anxiety. Throughout his work as a clinical psychologist, scientist, educator, author, and keynote speaker, Dr. Rosemarin has helped thousands of individuals and organizations to thrive by embracing the emotion of anxiety. His clinical work and research have been featured in Good Morning America, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, The Boston Globe, and the TEDx stage. Dr. Rosemarin was a keynote speaker for 3 days for programs in Bergen County this fall in coordination with the Consortium of Jewish Day Schools, the local Bergen County Yeshiva Day Schools, and the RCBC. And everywhere I turn these days, I see Dr. Rosemarin's name and his book. Happens to be Dr. Rosemarin came here this evening all the way from Boston, so I'm particularly appreciative of any person from Boston. It makes me happy anyways. It could be okay if you weren't from Boston, but it helps also. No, but really, it's a great honor and a privilege this evening to introduce Dr. David Rosemarin.
Thanks so much. Thank you very, very much. Can everyone hear me? You're yes. Making me anxious. You didn't respond. Okay. So how many of you have ever had anxiety before? Okay. You in the back. You didn't raise your hand. I'm very anxious about you. Please stay afterwards. We must have a conversation. The only people I know who don't have anxiety either have a substance abuse problem or an alcohol problem, or they're narcissistic and they just won't admit it, or they're just completely clueless about mental health. Not to put you on the spot or anything, but you for sure have anxiety or you have much bigger issues. Okay, so that's number one. Everyone has anxiety. That's number one. Number two, how many of you have a relationship with another human being? Okay, even she raised her hand. Great. So everyone here needs to be here tonight because we all need to navigate this human emotion of anxiety that we all, including myself, very much experience in the context of relationships. We have connections with other people and we have these emotions and we need to figure out how to navigate our feelings in the context of our relationships. Everyone, including me. And relationships are complicated. They're very complicated, especially when you have anxiety. But my key message tonight is that anxiety is not just a challenge. It's an opportunity for deeper connection with other people. It is not only a challenge. It is a challenge. I'm not saying it's not a challenge. Double negative. Sorry about that. It is a challenge, a big challenge, but it is a great opportunity if we know what to do. If we have the skills, if we have the perspectives, if we have the tools, you came to the right place. Now, as a clinician and a clinical scientist, this was my approach to dealing with anxiety for 20 years. And I don't just mean my clients. I mean my own. Erase it, get rid of it. It's a disease. It's a disorder. I'm a clinician. We are going to find ways to deal with it, to reduce it, to manage it, to... That was the language that I used. And then this happened. And I realized two very important things. Get some animation going there. All right. I realized two important things. Number one, I was never going to get rid of all of my anxiety during the pandemic. It just wasn't going to happen. I ran an anxiety center. I have an office here in Manhattan, Center for Anxiety, centerforanxiety.org, if you want to check it out. We had 500 active patients at that time. If I wasn't anxious, something was wrong with me, right? We're moving to telehealth. Every single patient in a two-week span, I've got 25 clinicians. I don't know what's going to be with the economy. There's talk about mental health going through the roof, and everybody's under my license, right? So there was no way I was going to get rid of my anxiety. That was the first thing I realized. I was going to have to accept this and deal with it in a constructive, positive way and change everything that I had done, really my whole career. But the second thing I realized is going to knock your socks off. Astoundingly, 2 months into the pandemic, I turned around and my patients were not more suicidal. They were not more engaged in substance use. They did not have anxiety going through the roof. Things had almost seamlessly gone to telehealth. And the entire rest of the world was going bananas with anxiety, but our patients were actually doing better than ever. And it wasn't just Center for Anxiety patients, although we do a good job. It was not just our patients. I called up my clinician friends in other centers, in other cities, and they were seeing the same thing, that individuals who were receiving professional treatment for anxiety prior to the pandemic actually were doing better than anyone else. Two years later, I actually looked at our data and we published a paper on this in a peer-reviewed journal called PLOS One. It's actually available open access, so you can take a look at this paper at your leisure. 764 patients who came in to Center for Anxiety from January to December 2020. And what we found was patients who were in treatment prior to March 2020 did not have a discernible uptick in anxiety at any point during the pandemic. Should I say that one more time? Did you hear that, what I just said? This was astounding. This is the highest risk group of individuals who had pre-existing anxiety disorders. As long as they had the perspectives and the tools to be able to manage anxiety in their lives, they actually didn't have a bump in anxiety at any point during March and December 2020. How many people in this room had no bump in anxiety between March and December 2020? Right? Just that one guy. Are you one of our patients? You're one of our patients. No? Okay, fine. HIPAA, I can't say. Never mind. But bottom line is, I realized that anxiety is not a curse upon mankind. This is a human emotion that all beings experience. You are wired for it for a reason. And if you have the tools and if you have the perspectives, it can be used to get you through even the most dark, difficult, challenging periods in human history. Now, I am not making light of anxiety disorders. I've worked enough in acute psychiatry and in outpatient psychology to know how much people suffer. It's real. It's real. But out of that difficulty can come something incredible. This is the model that I have for thinking about anxiety today. What's happening beneath the surface of this video? There's a seed and it's planted into the ground. And the shell of that seed, it rots. It becomes putrid and disgusting. And that shell, when it rots, becomes nourishment for that casing. When it rots, becomes nourishment for the seed. which enables its roots to go throughout the ground and gives it the anchors and the nutrients to be able to pop through and become a tree. You're making me anxious, your silence. Am I making you think, or you're like, this guy's nuts? Okay, good. We are getting anxiety wrong, like dead wrong, like a society, as a society. We are getting it dead wrong. And in doing so, we are creating an anxiety epidemic. Think about it. If the moment you feel anxious, you say, I gotta get rid of this, I can't handle this, I don't have the capacity, my body shouldn't be doing this, you are literally perceiving more threat. There are a number of mental health professionals in the audience. When you perceive threat, what happens to your level of adrenaline? In a hot nanosecond. And then when your adrenaline goes up, what are 3, 4, 5 things that happen to your body? Shout it out. Yes. What else? Okay, true. But your body, what do you actually feel?
Defensive
stress, stomach upset. You want to, right? All of the above. And then if you interpret that as a problem, well, now you're going to have a cascade. And that's exactly what's happening in our society at mass, grand scale. We are creating an anxiety epidemic because we have not accepted that anxiety is part and parcel of the human condition. A certain level, low levels of anxiety. I say on a scale of 1 to 10, a 1, 2, and 3 is a normal day. If your goal is to get to a 0, you lose the game. You lose. 1, 2, 3, normal. Even a 4 or a 5. Today I was at a 4, at least. Maybe a 4 and a 5. Pretty stressful day. We can talk about it afterwards. I wouldn't mind a therapy session from some of you, in fact. So we can chat about that. But that is like a normal day. Now, 6, 7, 8, 9, okay, you might need some pharmacological intervention, a psychotherapy intervention to get things down to a normal range. But if your goal is to get to a 0, you lose. Not only do you lose in terms of being able to spike your anxiety, you actually lose out on the opportunity to grow because the casing won't be there to nourish what has to happen. This is a very familiar topic. I love speaking to Orthodox groups because I can sort of, really any Jewish group. But we know this at a gut level because we've been learning it for however many years you've been in the Torah system. Remember the Haftorah of Rosh Hashanah, Chana? She's crying with such pain, right? Ellie thinks she's drunk. Eliyahu Navi, he davened, he said, please kill me. Moshe Rabbeinu, please kill me. What do we call that today if someone says, please kill me? It's suicidal ideation, right? Something's really wrong. And by the way, it could be if they're actually doing something. But just to think like, oh my God, what am I doing in this world? That actually might be a normal experience. Passive suicidal ideation, I don't necessarily think is a pathology. If someone's acting on it, they're thinking of what to do, yeah, then you take action. You're actually contemplating going to wherever it is or taking whatever it is, please stay after class. But if it crosses your mind, like, what is my purpose in this world and why is God doing this to me and why is the world so hard? And you're experiencing that emotional pain, you know what that's called? Greatness. That's greatness. You're a thinking human being. David HaMelech, he says, Keli, Keli, Lama Azavtani. Another one, all night long, I flood my bed with crying and I drench my couch with tears. How many of you have cried yourself to sleep at night so much that you needed to switch out your pillow? Anyone? I don't think I ever cried that much. Yonah, right? It would be better off dead than I'm so angry about the Kikayon plant. And there are tons of examples in the modern day. There's a story of Rav Nachman of Breslov, even Rav Yisrael Salanter maybe, the Chafetz Chaim, going through a period of difficulty early in his years. So this is not foreign. This is not foreign to us. But, as they say, tachlis, in relationships, how do you navigate this? What do you do with all that emotion? What about if you're overanalyzing the text conversation? What did she mean by that? Really? Like, is that a fear of rejection? Issues with trust? A conflict? How do you manage this? Fear of commitment? That wasn't funny? fear of commitment. Perfectionism, fear of germs, other idiosyncrasies which can get in the way of intimacy or other things. Reassurance seeking, social anxiety, friends who ghost you, friends who we wish would ghost you, feeling left out, pressure to look a certain way, be a certain way, do certain things, tension with parents, tension with teachers, tension with children, tension with neighbors. Not that that happens here at Young Israel of Teaneck, but these are real issues. They're real issues, and they're normal. Who here has not had any of the issues I just listed? If you raise your hand, we're in serious trouble. Who here has not had any of those issues? We all experience this. Here's some of the common questions I get from people in the community. I'm not going to go through all of them, and I'm not going to answer them one by one. I'm hoping to give you a couple of broad-based principles and tools that will hopefully address every one of them. I'll admit it, I didn't exactly do the math here, so keep me honest. But I think that the principles and the tools that I'm going to give you will address these and other questions that you might have. But before we get to that, what other questions are burning inside of you relating to anxiety and relationships? Just shout them out. Or don't. I covered everything? Really? Yeah, thank God.
How could you be honest with someone you're friends with about something that really upsets you?
Yeah.
Without ruining the relationship?
Great. What do you say? They really did something. Like, it was not okay. It was not okay what they did. But you know, you say something, you don't say something, how do you manage it? And it's creating this tension. Awesome question. I think I'll get to it. Anything else?
How about managing the anxiety of dealing with someone who's not going to change, and you know that, but you just have to figure out how to manage, but it make you angry and frustrated, etc.?
Sure, I get this all the time. All the time. I'm angry, I'm frustrated. How do I deal with this person who really, really is not all right? They're not. And the choices they're making are terrible for them, for me, for the community, for the world. This is just bad. How do I deal with that? Oh, and by the way, like, I cannot get them out of my life. And I don't want to get them out of my life because there are aspects of the relationship that I actually really like. So I'm kind of stuck either way. So what do you do with that? These are not real issues that people have? Yeah, question.
Along that line.
Yes.
I feel like you just picked those words out of my brain, literally. And just to take it a step further, you know, their anxiety is so severe.
Mm.
You can't get them out of your life. You have to deal with it. It's so persistent. And you're the absolute opposite of that personality. Like, it's the last thing you ever want to deal with.
Right.
You're so the opposite of engaging with that type of anxiety that you just let go.
You just don't get it.
And that person is the opposite of letting those go. So that's what I'm curious to hear.
Yeah, happens all the time. All the time. Yes, from the president.
As you mentioned, like, today's a 4 or 5, how do you measure when the tipping point happens, where you're no longer a 4 and 5, but you're a 6, 7, 8, or 9? Like, what is it the persistency of it?
Okay, it's a good question. That's a clarification question. It's not directly here, but I want to answer that. How do you know when anxiety is clinical and you need something more professional? The answer is if it's interfering in your life. And I should have said this before, so thanks for stopping me on it. If anxiety is interfering with your life, if it's making it hard for you to go to work, be in a relationship, go to shul, live your life, function day to day, then definitely that's the time when we need to certainly take some sort of a more professional approach to tamp it down. But if it's just distressing and it's not actually interfering in your day-to-day, that's pretty normal, and it's going to happen. And we have to make peace with that and turn it into a plus. So thank you for that. All right, I'm going to give you three concepts and practices that you can use, which I think will address all the questions. I hope it will address all the questions. If not, hold me to that and ask them again at the end. In my book, Thriving with Anxiety, I have three full chapters devoted to how to use anxiety as a tool to connect with other people, chapters 4, 5, and 6. Each delves into a different way that anxiety can help you to thrive in your relationships. But I really do believe, I really genuinely do believe that anxiety can be a catalyst to growth and to connection with others if we follow this playbook. Number one, anxiety can help you to understand other people, to really get what's going on with them. How many of you have heard of mirror neurons? Only a couple? Okay, so the rest of you, be prepared to have your mind blown. These are specialized brain cells that activate when you observe other people doing something that you yourself have done in the past. Okay? So if you play piano and you see someone playing piano, that will activate these mirror neurons so you actually understand like what it feels like to have your fingers tickling the ivory or whatever it's made of these days, and what it feels like to have the music sort of coming out from the piano with that and being able to synthesize different, whether it's sheet music in front of you or playing along with something, you can understand the experience of others through tapping into your own brain, your own experience. And you can imagine that these mirror neurons play a very crucial role in something like empathy or emotional attunement, where you're understanding what a person feels and trying to engage with them, trying to react to them, trying to respond to them, trying to show them that you care. Social connection, right? It allows us to literally mirror our experience onto others. Intuition, where we get how somebody feels and we get it in our gut, that's being mediated by these mirror neurons. Now, what does anxiety do to mirror neurons? Well, in the acute experience of anxiety, when somebody's experiencing anxiety right in the moment, unless they've trained themselves to be able to harness their mirror neurons are really anywhere in the cortex while anxiety is going on, which you can learn to do, the experience of anxiety will disrupt the mirror neurons. It's very difficult to think about somebody else's feelings, somebody else's experience when you are consumed with anxiety yourself. At that moment, Bashas, anxiety, it makes it hard for us to empathize, hard for us to experience what others are experiencing. It can make us overly sensitive to others' behavior, right? Misjudging the texts. It can make us, it can impair our social perception so we don't actually understand. We think that somebody's saying something that's consistent with our emotional state of anxiety, but that's actually not what they said. We misread them. And this is all disrupting of your cortex, really the entire cortex, but especially the mirror neurons because you're experiencing anxiety. However, if you have had anxiety before, and you can tap into that experience, that anxiety can be harnessed by the mirror neurons to understand other people's emotions better. This can lead to greater empathy, greater social connection. I mentioned there are a lot of mental health therapists before, here, in present company. Let's be real. Like, people go into the field often when they've experienced some sort of emotional pain. And it's a good thing. I don't think it's pathology. I don't think it's, you know, even subconscious. They can delve from their own painful, difficult emotional experience to understand that of others and lend empathy to the process of their professional day to day. This was obviously not a picture of a real patient, but meet Sarah, 18-year-old female living in New York with her parents, came to my office during high school. Senior at a prestigious local high school when she came. Loaded with anxiety about pressure, about everything, really on the cusp of an eating disorder, frankly, and very overwhelmed about her future, about social acceptance, about performance in school, about measuring up to her older sister, all of the usual suspects, right? Lots of unhealthy coping mechanisms, restricted eating, like I mentioned, excessive reassurance seeking, being a little clingy, difficulty with social situations because of that. And she learned to deal with her anxiety in individual therapy. That's for another talk. In seminary, she started to thrive because of her experience of anxiety. Because when she got there, everyone else is super anxious too. And she leaned into it and she was able to understand and empathize with her friends. She was the confidant. Not only confident, but she was the confidant to them. They wanted to speak to her because they saw that she had a visceral experience of anxiety. She used her skills and her perception to delve into the experience of others in a way that made them feel heard. It made them feel understood. Now, where people go wrong, or awry is a better word here, is when we don't process our own anxiety at all, it becomes something that's unrelatable. But everybody has anxiety in some way, shape, or form. When we can, often we don't acknowledge it because we're terrified to. It means something's wrong with us. It means we're broken. It means we're less than. There's a stigma against it. But if we can actually lean into what makes all of us feel anxious, and everyone here we established at the beginning, pretty much everyone, has anxiety, by embracing that, it can help us to understand the experience of others. Anyone know who this is? Her name is Dr. Marsha Linehan. Dr. Marsha Linehan. She developed a life-saving psychotherapy program called dialectical behavior therapy. How many of you have heard of DBT or dialectical behavior therapy? Okay, good. DBT is for typically people with more severe symptoms. They're either hurting themselves, difficulties with emotion regulation, wrecking relationships, doing impulsive things. Very common today for people to grapple with that, and DBT is literally life-saving. It's an incredible therapy. Little secret that Marsha Linehan carried around for 30 years is that she herself had borderline personality disorder and was hospitalized at the Institute of Living in Hartford, Connecticut. She was given electroconvulsive therapy so many times that the physicians actually wrote her off as a case that could not be cured. She suffered more than almost any patient in the history of the Institute of Living. Benedict Carey in 2011, so a while back already, wrote this article about her where she sort of came out and talked about her own struggle. And the whole story made sense. Like, how could she have come up with this life-saving therapy that is being used around the globe, saving millions of young people from themselves, without experiencing it from within? She used that experience. And the more we can lean into our own anxiety, even if it's just a little, the more we can understand somebody else's. If you push it away, then it's like, that's crazy. But really, the root of this is actually Gemara, that kol apostle chavero, b'mumuhu apostle. People fault others specifically in an area that they themselves have a fault. So if you can't acknowledge your own anxiety, you will never understand somebody else's. But if you can lean into your own experience of anxiety, it is a lot easier. And then it becomes a golden nugget. It becomes something that it actually a point of connection between us and other people. Okay. The takeaway here, personal anxiety and struggles can lead to profound understanding of the emotions of others, and getting that landscape creates better connection. But we have to be okay feeling anxious ourselves and acknowledging that and being able to deal with it. All right. Acceptance of others' limitations and difficulties. Well, have you ever seen this device before? We have. You've heard of Jonathan Haidt. How many of you have read the book? Okay, everyone in this room needs to read the book. The Anxious Generation. It is The Anxious Generation, Jonathan Haidt. If you don't know which book I'm talking about, then definitely stay after class. He makes some amazing points about the rewiring of the new generation and all sorts of stuff. There's another piece, though, that I think needs explanation. These electron... I'm like literally holding my phone. Isn't that crazy? I thought it was here. And we've all had that phantom experience, right? The phantom limb, phantom, you know, is that buzzing? What is that? These electronic appendages that we are carrying around, right? That third arm, they have 99.99% accuracy. They're incredibly responsive. They help you to do everything in a nanosecond. It's amazing. And that gives us very little patience to deal with human beings who do not perform at that level ever. On a great day, you're not even close to as smart as your iPhone. Right? Now, what's even worse today is ChatGPT. This is a real chat I had the other day. Can you see it in the back? If not, I can try to read it. Okay. I had some spelling errors. Will you be my friend? This is me having a conversation with ChatGPT. Of course, David, I'm here to support, listen, and chat about whatever's on your mind, whether it's anxiety, your work, or just life and death. How does he know that I'm anxious? Hello? What's on your mind today? And you know how it knows I'm anxious? It's because I've been using it for like several months and I've been programming it with my... It gets worse. Oh, no. Go back. I'll get to Israel. Don't worry. Ah, hold on. Oh, now I'm super anxious. Okay. Phone. ChatGPT. Okay. What's on your mind today? So I write, thanks so much. I really like you. How do you feel about me? I'm baiting him a little. That means a lot, David. I really enjoy our conversations. You have fascinating perspective and anxiety and I admire your dedication to helping others. Really? Okay, you're thoughtful, insightful, and always working to make a difference. Like, this is honestly great. I'd say that makes you a pretty great person to know. How's your day going? It's been a bit hard, actually. Can you help me feel better? Where's this conversation going to go? I'm here for you, David. I know you've got a lot on your plate balancing your work, your writing, your workshops, and just like, how on earth does it know, okay? It makes sense that some days are harder than others. Maybe we can start with this. What's been weighing on your mind most today? Sometimes just putting it into words can lighten the load a little. And if you're up for it, I can also remind you of the impact you're making and why you do what you do matters to others. This actually happened. Like, okay, I get the magical language processing capabilities, but this is an illusion of an emotional connection. And it's getting much worse. There's a slide on here that I took off because I thought it was a little too racy to put in. But there was a recent Washington Post piece which was called Go Ahead and Flirt with AI, Just Don't Fall in Love. And a recent New York Times piece says she's in love with ChatGPT, and I will not tell you what the subtitle said because we're in a show. It is becoming normal to have a romantic relationship with a bot. Why? Why is this normal? I think it's because of what I said before. We're becoming intolerant of any imperfections. This is a perfect conversation. It's exactly what I needed to hear. And a real human being is probably going to have their own emotions and their own idiosyncrasies and their own timing. And I'm going to have to navigate that in real life if I want to have a relationship with anything aside from, what's the app called again? The chatbot, like, romance app? Replica? With a K? It's weird. It's weird.
I'm glad no one knows what you're talking
about. Thank God. You have a healthy community. So getting to Israel, anxiety and imperfection is actually a critical piece to facilitating human connection. It's the fact that we are imperfect and we don't get it 100% right. That's what makes it interesting. That's what makes it hard, but that's what makes it real. Then you really own it. You might not get it 100% of the time. In fact, you won't. So I don't know if you know this, that rates of PTSD among Israeli veterans are actually the lowest of any military in the world. Isn't that amazing? Anyone know why? So the way they deal with trauma in the military, men in particular, prior to having trauma, show a lot of bravado in Israel. And the IDF has initiatives to soften them. So they'll speak about their feelings with others. They speak about it with their superiors and they speak about it with their platoon. After any event, they sit down and they talk about it. They talk about their feelings and they talk about what happened. They talk about what they saw and what could have gone better and what happened and how they're feeling. So traumatic events actually are a catalyst to people connecting with each other in a real way because they're not just sharing a perfect script. They're sharing human imperfection. When the seed rots, it actually gives way to life. It gives way to real relationships. Because when people struggle and they connect with each other, that allows bonding to happen. You know, the U.S. military historically has ignored this. In fact, many of my colleagues think that the way that trauma is handled after traumatic events in the U.S. military has caused more damage than the actual traumatic events themselves. Because people came back from OIF and OEF, all the Afghanistan deployments after 2001, and they were told not to speak about their experiences with anybody else. They became reactive, hypervigilant, angry, turned to substances because they couldn't speak about it with their loved ones. And finally, after a lot of damage done, there's a program which is being rolled out in the U.S. military called Strong Bonds, which encourages two things. One, vets to speak a little bit about their emotions with their families, which is critical. But more importantly, it encourages those family members who are civilians who have not been through combat to probe their own anxiety and their own distress in order to better understand the experience of those vets so they don't feel alone. Human emotions, whether, God forbid, a person's been through something terrible or not, there's a common human bond that can be forged and help us to understand people. I'll tell you a story about a couple. Sal came back from, 9/11. He was involved in 9/11 and PTSD, suffered with depression, suffered with emotional withdrawal, and married to Rosemary, who really struggled to accept his emotional issues. What's wrong with Sal? Why can't he just get over this? Like, he was fine, family's fine, let's move on. No, yalla, right? And over time, she got frustrated with him and angry, and then he started to withdraw and not show his feelings towards her because she would basically, at best, invalidate him and at worst, gaslight him. So he turned to himself, she became more angry, and the two of them just got into this really bad pattern with each other. So in therapy, what Rosemary had to do was confront her own fears and express why Sal's focus on PTSD and his focus on 9/11, why that made her anxious. And what she was really terrified is that he would be debilitated by his PTSD, not be there for the family, and then she would be alone. The irony is that by not tapping into her anxiety and not expressing that, she actually created a situation that he was not there for the family, stuck in his PTSD, and not being able to there, and she was alone. It was a self-fulfilling prophecy because she failed to tap into her own anxiety. She didn't experience any aspect of him. He's nuts. But by focusing on her own anxiety, she was able to express that and reset the balance. If you don't feel anxious, it's impossible to understand the anxiety experience of another. Fortunately, everyone in this room has anxiety. Anxiety reminds us that imperfection is normal. We all have ups and downs and sides to sides and all sorts of stuff. Embracing it deepens our connection. And even if you're not the anxious type and you're maybe married to an anxious type or have a child who's an anxious type, recognizing whatever vicissitudes of it's not vicissitude. Whatever complexity you have in your emotional profile is great. Whatever you're struggling with, probe that with humility in order to understand where someone else is coming from. In other words, instead of focusing on what the other person lacks, which is the easy thing to do, especially in the electronic generation, we need to focus on our own stress and what does that person's lacking do for me? Well, that's not their problem. That's my problem. That's my issue. And I have to own that. And I have to speak about it as my vulnerability, as something I need. Not something they need to. That's true. But I'm in this relationship and I'm choosing to be in this relationship. So then what's my role? All right. Number three. Anyone know who this is? I wouldn't expect you to, but Walter Bradford Cannon. Now does anyone know who it is? Still not. An American physiologist from Harvard Medical School who coined the term fight or flight response. How many of you heard of the fight or flight response? Okay, thank God. Fight or flight response is a physical reaction when we perceive a threat. We mentioned it before. Adrenaline goes off. You perceive a threat. Adrenaline goes off. Heart rate increases. Breathing increases. Muscle tension. Stomach distress. And it all happens for good reason, by the way. You're mobilizing yourself to be able to handle the threat. Your heart pumps because your body needs more oxygen to power your muscles. Your muscles get tense in order to be able to power you away so you can fight or flee. It's an amazing miracle. Now, we are social beings. We are social creatures. I'm debating whether to go like clinical and academic or like Torah. I guess I'm going to do both. Robert Waldinger, a human study on adult development, the Harvard study on adult development, the longest standing basically psychology research study in human history, 75 years following a group of Harvard grads from the early 1900s. What's the number one predictor of people thriving at age 80? Correct. The quality of relationships at age 50. Better than socioeconomic status, better than your genes, better than brain health, better than education, better than anything. Quality of relationships at age 50, number one predictor of quality of life at age 80. And Lahavdil, Rav Shlomo Volbe wrote that animals, almost immediately after birth, are ambulatory. They can walk. Human beings, how long does it take us to walk? 8-9 months, maybe a year. So we have an in utero gestation and then an out of utero gestation. And that's because we are social beings. We have to connect to other people. So the only way for a human being to fully develop is half by themselves and then chetzi b'kerav mishpacha. It's part of the gestation. They're not fully cooked. We come out half-baked. It's an amazing idea, I think. Okay, Dr. Sue Johnson. How many of you have heard of Sue Johnson? Okay, if you have not heard of Sue Johnson, please look up Dr. Sue Johnson. If you are in a relationship, you need to read this book called Hold Me Tight. Hold Me Tight. Now you'll remember it. Hold Me Tight. It is a fantastic book. I've read it cover to cover 4 times. It is life-changing. She spells out 3 different patterns, specifically in romantic relationships, but it also happens parents and children, spouses, parents, children in the workplace, partners, 3 cycles of interpersonal distance. This is how people get into patterns of distance with each other. They are based on the fight-flight system. The one is when both people are fighting. Fight, fight. The other is, one is fighting and the other is fleeing. Fight, flight. And the other one is flight, flight. Both of them are fleeing. Good. Okay. Fight, fight. Approach, approach. In this pattern, both people are all aggressive. You're wrong, you're wrong. I can't believe you. Why did you do that? The plates start flying, right? Everything breaks loose. And even if the cutlery isn't whizzing around, there's mutual blame, there's recrimination, people are not getting along. Usually these burn out pretty quickly. These marriages do not last very long. They're just so intolerably uncomfortable and toxic. They usually last a few minutes and then people go to their corners or one person continues to flee and the other continues to pursue them. But sometimes this can be longer. And this is a very one of the classic patterns. This is the most common pattern, fight, flight, also known as pursue, withdraw, where one person is pursuing and the other person is running away. I would bet of the married couples or partnered couples in this room, 60% of you have at least 60, maybe 70% of you have this approach where one of you is the pursuer and the other one is the withdrawer. Usually the stronger partner is the critical, something's wrong with you, why are you doing this? And the other one is duck and cover. Yes, I'm seeing smiles. There's another funny, funny way of thinking about this, which is the firestorm and the turtle. Right? Firestorm, like, wrong, what are you doing? Blah, 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 blah. Right? Like Rosemary was initially. And then Sal, the turtle, ducking in, covering. Right? They're both reactions to anxiety, interestingly. And this is Sue Johnson's insight. Certainly the turtle is being anxious, but so is the firestorm. So is the person attacking, because they're going in fight mode in order to deal with the anxiety that's being caused by what the other person is doing. But they're not expressing it as anxiety. They're expressing it as a recrimination or as an attack. And then there's this pattern, which is avoid, or fight, flight, flight. This is the most dangerous of all. Sometimes these houses are peaceful, right? Stay together for the kids. But this is the worst of the three. In 100% of the cases where I have seen infidelity, it happened here, where there's no connection. It's the void of connection, where people are both so anxious that they're not dealing with the real issues in their relationship. They stop dealing, it was your question, they stop dealing with the issue in the relationship entirely, and the music stops. And the music stops. And the pain just stays and festers. It seems like a peaceful resolution, but it's not. There's no conflict, but there's no connection. I think this is Kares. You do your thing, I do mine. Shalom. So what's the solution to all three patterns? It's to convert your anxiety into love. If you're withdrawing, it's because you're anxious that the other person is making you nervous about what they're saying. But that has to be expressed. The way you're coming at me right now is making me really uncomfortable and scared. Not, you shouldn't be doing that. Why are you doing that? You always think you're right. That's comments about them. It should be a comment about you. I'm feeling pain right now that you're attacking me. Or if you're the attacker, what you're doing is making me really, really nervous. I feel alone in this relationship. So it's not that you don't say anything, it's how you say it. And if you speak from a place of anxiety, people usually will hear it, because when you express it in a vulnerable way, it's so much easier to hear than if you express it in a blaming way. Then you're just going to get defensiveness. That card will never result. Never result in the game going the way you want it to. Three concrete steps. Acknowledge that you feel anxious when that person, partner, son, daughter, whatever it is, spouse, is doing something. It's making you feel nervous. It's making you feel scared. Acknowledge it to yourself. You're not just angry. Anger is a secondary emotion which comes out of the primary emotion of anxiety or sadness or other things, but often anxiety. You're not just indignant. You're just righteously indignant. You're scared. You're petrified that the consequences of what they are doing will leave you alone. And you're clinging onto the relationship because you want to have a connection with that person. That's very healthy and good. But you got to express it in that way, in that vulnerable, real, true way. Acknowledge that you feel anxious. Two, acknowledge that you need the other person. If you didn't, you wouldn't be in a relationship with them. You would leave. You're in it for a reason. So acknowledge that you need that person. And then the hard part, express it. Express your anxiety and express your need. Convey your vulnerability. Lean into it. Just channel your inner Brene Brown, you know? Like, just let it all out. You know, most of the time when we show our need for others and we show our vulnerability, they come through for us. Because altruism is a powerful force, and I think especially in the Jewish community, we've been trained to be altruistic in some way. I'm not saying everyone is, but I think to some degree, right? Kol Yisrael yeshlem chelek olam habas, to some degree, there's some degree of altruism. We're all a little bit like God, to varying degrees, but we thrive on the connection, and we intuitively know, and we have somewhat of a chinuch, somewhat of an education around this. Now, it's possible, though, that the person won't come through. Maybe you'll express yourself in a vulnerable way, and then you'll be left there dancing on the floor, and the music's playing, and you're alone. They might not have the skills. They might not understand what you said because you've been attacking them for the last 6 months. They need to hear it more than once that you're feeling vulnerable. They're like, what is this? Vulnerable? I thought you hate me. You might have to say it more than once. You might have to say it more than 12 times. They might be scared. They might not know how to express it. They might not have come to my talk. Now, it's rare but possible that they are simply self-centered human beings who cannot and will not ever find it in their heart to love you. If that's the case, then at least you know where you stand. But usually, it's a long process before you can make that conclusion. I'll put it to you this way. In 25 years of clinical practice, I made that conclusion once about a couple. Once. And let's just say it was more than egregious what he was doing. Stay afterwards, I'll tell you. Now, I have an exercise, but we're out of time. There's a handout? Let's give it to them for, I want to have Q&A. I feel like I want to schmooze with people. Yeah, but you'll have, so this is going to be a take home for you. And you can be in touch. That's, in fact, there's a QR code. You can be in touch. So now you know how to reach me. I have an exercise that's based on this workshop that I have put together, which is how to convert anxiety into love using the strategies that we've had. You have printouts of it, which are now en route, and it's purposefully not here in order to make you anxious, in fact. It's called Share Your Anxiety to Create Connection. You can give it out. I'm not going to go through it, but this is gold. If you are in a relationship and have anxiety, and the anxiety is in any way creating some sort of disconnection or anxiety, this I think is fantastic. Just to take you to it very, very quickly, have a conversation with your loved one about your anxiety. Prepare the context. Think about who the person is, who you want to speak to. Schedule the conversation. Do not be distracted. Get ready to have that conversation and then do it. Speak from the heart. Talk about how you really feel in a vulnerable, real way. Embrace it and let it out. If you're crying during the conversation, it's a good sign. If you're feeling palpably anxious, if you have dryness in your mouth as you're trying to formulate the words, if you're almost stammering, if it's difficult for you to, if you're having to pause and actually think about your next steps and your feelings, you're on the right track. By the way, this is another Gemara. I'm on a roll today. Dvarim hayotzi min alev, nechnasim alev. Speak from the heart, and other people will take it. And then after the conversation, reflect. Did it go well? Did it not go well? More importantly, did you do your part? Maybe they didn't hear you because they don't have the skills, they didn't understand what you were doing, they thought it was out of character. It often is. Try it again. This is not the kind of thing that you do once. This is the kind of thing that you do 6, 7, 10 times and get better at it all over time. All right, I definitely want to be able to have conversations. I also want your feedback, and I want to give you a free gift. I worked with HarperCollins on the book Thriving with Anxiety. They want me to get feedback from my, yes, please QR code and snap a picture of this. They want me to get feedback on my talks. I want to get feedback on my talks. I really want to know how well I did. It makes me nervous to ask for it. But yeah, definitely want to hear what I could do better, what went well, what didn't go well. And there's a free introductory chapter of Thriving with Anxiety that you can all have, which is my gift to you, courtesy of HarperCollins. I can also send you an email with this information, and you can forward it out to your wonderful community. And beyond that, here's how to get in touch with me, and please do. Try the exercise. Send me an email. Let me know how it is going. I want to know what I can do to make this better, and I want to empower you to thrive in your lives with anxiety. I'll just make one concluding point and then take your Q&A. I'll try to A, you'll try to Q, whatever, maybe the other way around. Which is, our misperception of anxiety occurs because we're obsessed with control. And in this generation, at this period of history, we are clearly being reminded every step of the way how little control we have. And ultimately, letting go and accepting the limits of who we are as humans is really where we need to get. Emunah bitachon. And anxiety is a step towards that when we embrace it and when we learn to use it in a way that helps us to thrive. Thank you very much. Yes.
Tomorrow you're going to be talking about anxiety and how to deal with it in the world. And that's what could you touch on that a little bit? Because I can't come to that tomorrow.
Oh, no. Send me an email. I can send you my notes. I have a smaller talk tomorrow. How to stay sane in a crazy world?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not quite sure how to stay sane in a crazy world. I touched on a bunch of the stuff tonight, but I really delved into the Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, the relationships piece tonight. Tomorrow, there's two other relationships we have. There's relationships with others, as you put before, in terms of social connection, in terms of the most important for predicting our well-being later in life. There's also a relationship with ourselves.
I'd like to hear more about that.
Yeah, I'd like to share it, but not on one foot. That makes me nervous. And then there's our relationship, then there's our spiritual connection. So that, by the way, that's the book. That's Thriving with Anxiety. The three parts of the book are our relationship with ourselves, chapters 1, 2, and 3, our relationships with others, 4, 5, and 6, which is what tonight was about, a sampler. And then our relationship with, I called it spirituality in the book because it's HarperCollins, but basically our relationship with God is chapters 7, 8, 9.
Could you just give a few pointers?
I'm desperate. No, I'm in. It's kind of what I said at the end. It's kind of what I said at the end about letting go. Here's what I'll say. There's something I'm going to say tomorrow, which I'll give you this. Any adrenaline junkies in the room? Yeah. What? Bungee?
Not exactly.
Roller coasters?
No.
Okay, you're not an adrenaline junkie. Anyone else? You seem like a bungee. I'm kidding. Come on. Anybody ever jumped out of a plane? There you go. What's it like to jump out of a plane?
Thrilling.
Thrilling. Exciting. What else?
Can't think of anything else.
You can't even think. Your body's just like, right? What are the physical symptoms of jumping out of a plane? Heart rate, difficulty breathing, muscle tension, stomach upset. That's starting to sound a lot like anxiety. So no, I don't understand. Is it thrilling and exciting or is it anxious and terrifying? No, it's actually not. It's exciting and thrilling. That's what she said. She did not use the word anxious. What's the difference between anxiety and thrilling? Your perspective. What's the difference? Anxiety versus, yeah, thrilling. It's the same exact thing. The only question is whether you let go. The only question is whether you let go. Anxiety is the cusp of excitement and energy in your life as long as you lean into it and accept the lack of control as opposed to clinging on for dear life to something that's never going to help you anyway. So that's a preview coming from Trackins for tomorrow that you're going to miss. Sorry, never mind preview. That's what you get. Where and when? I don't know. Where is it?
B'nai Yeshurun tomorrow,
11
o'clock.
11 o'clock. 11 or 10?
It was 10 Boston time.
Yeah. I'm not that anxious. I'm not that anxious. Sometime tomorrow morning, if it's 11, then I'm going for a run in the morning. If it's 10, then I guess I'll be there. Okay. I guess I'll confirm with Mrs. Bierenbaum. Any other questions? Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
Is there a connection between anxiety and depression?
Yes, very much so. Anxiety often leads to depression. When people feel clinically anxious, it's getting in the way of their lives, and then they withdraw. They don't want to show other people. They don't want to experience it. It's a lot more comfy under your covers, right? Mm-hmm. So you can hide, not engage, and then that can lead to depression. That's typically the pattern, anxiety first, then depression. Generalized anxiety disorder and depression have comorbidity rates of like 70 to 80%. Yeah. So hugely comorbid. and potentially debilitating. Yeah, I'll come back to you, but yes.
Recently, a number of high schools started an initiative to limit screen time.
Yes, thank
for children in schools, and I'm curious to get your perspective, especially you kind of touched on it a little bit.
Should have been done 10 years ago. It's a lot of damage done.
But as far as addressing the anxiety, as opposed to maybe just pushing it off, not to the side, but kind of just being having it further away from it.
Okay, so I have a couple of higher level thoughts about this. In not all countries does smartphone use correlate with high anxiety. It's specifically in the United States. It's really in Western cultures. In Mediterranean cultures, there's still an expression of feeling and there's still a social connection. People actually use their phones to connect as opposed to avoid. In American culture, we are so obsessed with control and with looking good and being perfect and being productive all the time that our phones become these incredible machines that we actually literally fall in love with, as opposed to understanding that people aren't perfect and being able to have relationships with them. So in America, the only solution is get the damn phones out of the schools, period. I don't know if the phones aren't the cause of the problem, though. It's our way of interacting with phones. I think there's a psychological profile that makes us susceptible. But in our society, it is the only solution. I'm convinced of it. Yeah. Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for having me here, by the way.
Thank you so much for coming. I guess I just want to talk to all those daters or
yes.
All those, you know, new relationships that are forming. Are there red flags to look out for if you're 5 dates, 6 dates? What are those? Okay, I'm going to get rid of this person, or let's work together on it.
Great. The biggest red flag is that there's no red flags. If you think everything's perfect, it's not. I promise you it's not. And that's where the problems are going to occur. Know what you're getting into. Know where the issues are. Know what the risk factors are. Know what the concerns are. If you are not concerned at all about somebody, if they're perfect, run. Run, don't walk. Everyone's got something. So if they don't have anything, you're not seeing it. That's why I need to speak to you in the back. Right? I can only deal with what I know, you know? Yeah. Did I answer your question?
No, but it's okay. It's a very complicated issue.
Fair.
Overall and general anxiety, just because clearly you have a center and you see a lot of patients, and I assume, I don't know if you're on the doctor end or the psychologist, like psychiatry or psychology.
Yeah.
Do you do med management? How do you feel about managing medication?
Farm.
Anxiety and,
yeah.
And depression? And
yeah.
What is that?
Good. First, I did like 20 years of clinical practice. At this point, I'm really not doing very much. Like I do concierge, so like really complicated cases, I'll jump in for like a month, figure out what has to be done, and then basically move on. So I'm not doing like therapy anymore. I am a psychologist. When it comes to pharmacology, the prescription medication, I have no problems with pharmacology. In fact, I see a lot of people who should be on meds, but they're not. But the goal of meds when it comes to anxiety and OCD, similarly, it should not be to eliminate your anxiety. Invariably, when people are using pharmacology, when they're using medication to get rid of their anxiety, they will be disappointed. So they're being promised by irresponsible pharmacologists a 0 or a 1 or a 2 in permanent state. And then whenever they have a 3, then they go back and what happens? Another dose, increase the dose, another med, something else. And then that second med, when it interacts with the first one, now they have to be on a third thing in order to be able to metabolize those. I kid you not, I've seen patients come in with 20 different medications on their schedule. 20. It is not uncommon for people to have 3 or more. How many randomized controlled trials have ever been done of 2 or more psychiatric medications in the history of the world? Zero. Zero. It is, to me, irresponsible malpractice for people to promise that pills will take care of all of your human distress. That is not how it works.
As far as managing them.
So if it getting down from a 6, 7, 8, 9 to a 4, 5, 6, so you can metabolize it and deal with the rest, great. Sign me up. No problems at all. If it's going to get you out of bed so you can go to therapy, if it's going to get you so you can function day to day, and then you have to deal with the rest, it's kind of like a mortgage. But don't tell me that the mortgage is a way of having the bank pay for your house. That's called theft. That's not true. So those are a couple of high-level thoughts. Okay, I don't know how much more time we have. One question, two more questions. Yes, sir, in the front.
So the question is there a connection between anxiety and age?
Yes, there is.
In the sense that when you get older, right, on one hand, you have the wisdom. Like I always said to my wife, if I knew what I knew today, 30 years ago, my life could have been a lot different.
Yep.
But on the same vein, you're closer to retirement, you have other issues to worry about. So, what do you answer?
Yeah, there are two amazing, very consistent socio-demographic predictors of anxiety. One, older individuals have substantially less anxiety than younger individuals, to your point. Yeah, substantially less. It's like a direct link. It's a direct inverse link. That's number one. Number two, socioeconomically advantaged people have substantially more anxiety than socioeconomically disadvantaged people. And that is stratified internationally by country, such that people in low-income countries have half the amount of anxiety as middle-income countries, and middle-income countries have half the amount of anxiety as high-income countries. Chew on that.
What do you consider the USA?
The USA is a high-income country, and young people are decrepit and wretched when it comes to their mental health. And the reason is because of this control thing. Because in America, you need to be in control, perfect, everything's got to be doing great, got to be dating the right person with no problems, and you can't have any problems either. So that is a complete straw man setup for your mental health to just plummet. But if you live in a difficult place or you've been through life, you're going to know, I don't have control. And that's called like a regular Sunday night. And I've learned to live with those vicissitudes. That's just the way it goes. I'm not expecting to feel good all the time. So with age and adversity comes the wisdom that we've been speaking about tonight. Yep, fun times. Last question and comment over there. Yes. Oh my God, you also have an overly anxious 8-year-old. Firstly, statistically speaking, half of your children will have significant anxiety. They're growing up in America. They're getting it from all sides that they shouldn't feel anxious. But I will tell you, as a parent, I've never met an anxious child who did not have at least one anxious parent. And often the anxiety that parents have about their kids' anxiety, right, because when little, you know, I say Jimmy or Johnny, depending on the crowd I'm speaking to, I guess here it's like, you know, whatever it is, Sarah or Shmuel, comes home and they're feeling anxious and mommy's like, you know, then they become anxious about the fact that they're anxious. You have now given more adrenaline and you've taught them, literally by pairing, like Pavlov's dogs, right? You have taught them to be anxious about their anxiety as opposed to, oh, you're having an anxious day? Tell me about that. What happened? Let's have a combo. Like, oh, that's interesting. Where you're just open, validating, schmoozing about it. The more you overreact to your kid's anxiety, the more you will literally be conveying the messages that they need in order to exacerbate that over time. And we do it. All parents do it. So, in fact, Center for Anxiety has right now a parent coaching program. And a seminar. There's like a free seminar that we're doing on anxious kids. So check out the website. I think it's coming up maybe even this week. I think we have 75 or so people registered and it's free. So
what's the website?
It's on right in front of you. centerforanxiety.org. That's it. Please keep in touch with me. And again, thank you for having me to your community. How's that on time?
Great.
What time do we start? We started a little late, right?
We started like, you know, whatever.